So welcome everyone. It's great to be with all of you today. I hope you and your loved ones are well and safe and healthy. I'm Kate Westfall. I'm COO of Global Ag Investing, or GAI. And on behalf of our CEO, Greg Mellinger, and the whole GAI team, we just want to say thank you for the enthusiasm you've shown for the report. Over the past few years, we recognized the need for a sort of inventory of our sector in terms of active funds, AUM, acreage, et cetera. So our sister division on the advisory side, HighQuest Partners, has put a tremendous amount of effort into compiling the data and creating a report that we hope will be valuable to all of you for years to come. For those of you who are interested in making updates to your profiles in the report for the 2020 edition, we do have a way for you to do that fairly easily at rankingsprofile.globalaginvesting.com. You don't have to write that down right now, don't worry. I will send it to everyone as a follow-up. But we do hope you'll participate actively and get your details out there so that we can make the 2020 version even more robust than the one that we put out this year that we're very proud of. After the presentation, we're going to move into 30 minutes of Q&A about, and we're going to try to end promptly at 2 o'clock. I do ask if you please can hold adding your questions into the chat box until the Q&A portion. That'll help me sort of keep track of the questions versus having them come in, you know, at different points throughout the presentation, because something that you have a question about might get answered over the course of the presentation. So if you can hold those until you see the slide that says Q&A, that would be super helpful. And without further ado, it's my absolute pleasure to introduce you to the valiant authors of the report, Philippe de la Perouse and Mark Zavadnik.
Thank you, Kate, and welcome everyone. Great to be here, and we're delighted to be able to have this opportunity to present the work that Mark, my colleague Mark, and I have worked on for the last over the last 6 months. So, we have a lot to present. So, I'm going to go straight to cut to the chase, and we'll just on this first slide give you the agenda, provide the introduction to the report, some background and some explanations of taxonomy and our the approach we took to undertaking this endeavor. Mark then will present the ag investing ranking tables and how we developed those. And then together we'll present some findings that we developed from the data that we were able to compile and profiles we created on different organizations that are raising and deploying capital in the food and agricultural sector, along with fund analysis. Then we'll present some key highlights and trends, a kind of a synopsis, distillation of what was presented in the report, followed by some discussion about what we see, what we've recorded and have noted in the first quarter of this year in terms of fundraising and commitments of capital. So, you know, noteworthy ones. Then particularly maybe not so much for the active asset managers in the space, but there are members of the media that are participating in this webinar. We just wanted to make the point about sustainable returns in food and agriculture, looking at those returns, particularly as it relates to farmland in the U.S. and Australia, where there is substantial institutional capital invested. Then touch on some of the impact of the coronavirus pandemic now. What the issues are, both near and short term, and maybe some opportunities for investors, and then Q&A. So, global. So, the whole, as Kate indicated in her remarks, food and agriculture over the last 10 years, now 11 years since we started the conference in 2009. Well, you know, the sub theme has been, you know, is agriculture, is food and agriculture emerging as a distinct asset class? And I think about 3 or 4 years ago, Bruce Sherrick at our New York event kind of answered the question and said, yes, in fact, it has. And you could refer to the energy industry as an analog in terms of its the wide range of opportunities that the sector offers different classes of investors for allocation. So what we decided to do with this inaugural report is to build a platform on which we in future years intend to expand it and to hopefully make it more granular. But for this first year, we wanted to focus on investment strategies and vehicles used to raise and deploy capital, the volume of capital assets under management deployed in the sector globally by alternative investment strategy. Also take a cut on geographic focus of investment activity, and then, you know, looking at allocations being made by investors to the space. So we, you go to the, in the middle, we've identified, and we had to identify the different players by category in order to be able to do this analysis. And as you will see further in the report, asset managers comprise the lion's share of actors, if you will, participants in this sector, but agribusinesses, DFI, sovereign wealth funds, technology accelerators that also have, that are deploying not only grants but are raising funds to promote early stage investment in food and ag are also players. And then what has also developed are family offices and pension funds that are investing directly in a substantial way. So we've also included them in our first inaugural report. Our hope is down the road to include family offices and pension funds that are investing in funds or as LPs, not directly, and then government and trade associations. And so the focus, again, is on alternative asset strategy, investment strategies in the sector, real assets being farmland, private equity, investing in operating strategies across the value chain, credit debt, both public and private. At some point, we might distinguish between the two. Venture capital, of course, impact investing, which is quite significant, infrastructure and liquid investments. This is just a depiction, an illustration of the map of what we were trying to cover. Don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think what's important down at the bottom is to look at the investment strategies that are allocating into these various points along the value chain. And that's something that will come up further in our presentation, and you've probably seen in the report, is that there are, investors are pursuing different types of investment strategies at different points along the value chain. And that's where nuance comes in, because it's a lot of players are now becoming much more sophisticated about how they're allocating capital and are investing across different types of asset investment strategies. And then one of the key things we had to do at the beginning, and it's open to debate, we realize that, but we needed to have a starting point. And this is something that we will be able to develop over time. We can, in the years ahead, we have the ability with the model or the database that we've created, and to restructure some of this as we go forward, and to add or to even become more granular. But you know, we had to identify what the organization types were, as I just discussed, the operating structures that they were using to raise and deploy capital, the investment strategies that they were pursuing, and then the types of production crops activities that they were financing in the field, out throughout globally, and then the geographic focus. So now Mark is going to discuss the ranking table that we developed. Mark?
Philippe, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I hear you now, Mark.
Okay. Sorry about that. Great. Okay, so we're going to get right into our ranking tables. And in total for the report, we produced 15 tables. Today, we're only going to talk about three. But the tables themselves, we ranked organizations by either their ag-focused AUM or by the acreage in which they manage. And the 15 tables were ranked by either their investment strategy. So by investment strategy, we mean farmland or private equity or venture capital or what have you, or their geographical region. And Philippe alluded to this a moment ago, but just a quick note regarding investment strategies. As the sector is becoming more nuanced, the organizations are increasingly deploying capital to more than one investment strategy. So for example, they might be deploying capital to farmland and venture capital, but they're not always disclosing what percentage of their total assets under management are in farmland versus venture capital. So for the purposes of this exercise, we allocated 100% of an organization's AUM to the primary strategy for the purpose of getting some context and breadth and depth to the sector as a whole. So, you know, certainly as we continue this process in future years, we certainly expect increased granularity as we progress, but that's the starting point that we're working with today. So now we're going to jump into the first table. So this is the top 30 ag investors overall. So that's the top 30 organizations of the 698 in which we profiled. And just a couple of quick comments as you're looking at these top 30. They account for $88.6 billion in ag-focused AUM, or 68% of the total $131 billion that we identified in our research. So we can see that AUM is very much weighted towards the largest organizations who are investing in food and ag. As Philippe said earlier on, asset managers very much are the majority of our overall sample, and that's definitely the case with the top 30 asset organizations. 21 of the top 30 are asset managers. And then one other point I would note, if you look in the column marked investment strategy, you'll see 15 of the top 30 ag investors are investing in farmland. And as we'll see here, that's going to be a theme in today's webinar, in that farmland investing, while not necessarily presenting the returns profile that all investors are looking for, very much is the cornerstone investing in food and ag. And that will be something we'll continue to talk about today. So now we're going to move to the next table, which is going to be the top 30 farmland investors by ag AUM. And again, here we do see it's similar in that from an AUM perspective, the farmland investors have $47 billion in ag-focused AUM, or 36% of the total, which again was $131 billion. So we see more than a third of AUM total that we identified is attributed to farmland investing. And 12 of the top 30 are pursuing a multi-strategy approach, meaning they're, as I said before, they're investing in not just farmland, but in these cases also private equity or infrastructure as well. So we're again seeing a multi-strategy approach here. If we move on to one more ranking table briefly, it's the top 25 private equity ag investors. And what we see here, the top 25 account for $17.5 billion in ag AUM, or 13% of the total. From a geographic standpoint, it's very much widely distributed across the globe, with a number of organizations deploying capital in a private equity strategy on a global basis. And we're seeing a range of operating strategies in terms of where investment is going, ranging from animal protein production to aquaculture to food processing. So really across that value chain that Philippe presented earlier, we're seeing from the private equity side capital being deployed.
Yeah, so now, as you saw on the first page regarding the ranking tables, of course, and you've seen this in the report, we provided another 14 tables ranking according to different categories. So that's something that, obviously, we're open to discussion about separately. Now looking at the investor analysis, this slide provides a breakdown showing that 39% of total ag AUM is being deployed and pursuing farmland strategies, followed by credit debt, both private and public, and then private of 32%, and then 14%. So this shows you that there's a wide range of allocations that investors are pursuing in the category of food and agriculture. And venture capital is a small piece of it, but a growing piece nonetheless, and with a lot of actors involved. Then, as we said at the beginning, asset managers account in terms of organizations, number of organizations, for 86% of the total universe of 698 that we have identified. And of course, a lot of the fundraising and deployment of investment activity takes place within that category of investors. But it's important, we think, to also be tracking the other participants, investors, such as agribusinesses, accelerators, DFIs, family offices, and sovereign wealth funds. So smaller in number, they're all part of the ecosystem. And we do think that, and we anticipate that they'll be account for a larger share, not only in terms of percentage of actors in the spaces we move forward, but also in terms of AUM that's raised and deployed in the sector. And then finally, focusing specifically on the asset managers, you can see here that the majority, 450 out of the 597 in our universe, are raising and deploying funds using a commingled fund strategy, or a vehicle, I should say, general partnership, limited partnerships, to raise capital, followed by corporations. And then, of course, you've got a breakdown of the other separately managed accounts only, or separately managed accounts, and commingled funds. And then there are 101 other ag investors using other vehicles that we're not laying out here in the for this exercise. So, Mark?
Thank you, Floyd. So now we're looking at the ag AUM range among the 597 asset managers who were part of our sample of the 698 total organizations. And this trend of concentration at the top really continues here, where we can see that 17 of the asset managers have an ag AUM greater than $1 billion. And then looking at the next slide, this is investment strategies deployed by the 698 ag investors. And what jumps out here are, and let me first say, so what you're seeing is the bar chart represents a number of organizations pursuing these strategies. So what we're saying for venture capital, that means 302 organizations of the 698 are pursuing a venture capital strategy. And obviously that's the first thing that jumps out. And I think what I would say to that is, you know, opportunities in ag tech have attracted a large number of VC firms to food and ag, and I think that's really represented here. Additionally, if you look at private equity, private equity and real assets make up 51% of the strategies being deployed. So on this next slide is a map, and I'll just kind of to give you a second to try to get oriented here. The yellow dot on the map indicates the number of ag investors with a headquarters in the particular region. And the blue dot is the percentage of ag investors who are investing or deploying capital in the region. So in the case of North America, we can see that 354 of the 698 organizations claim to have it headquarters in North America, and 44% are investing there. And I think that's not surprising given the role that the U.S. has played in investing in food and agriculture globally, or historically, I should say. But when we look at it at a wider scale, we really see that, particularly when you look at the global investing number of 18% of these organizations are investing, we deem on a global scale. Ag investing today is very much global in nature. So now we're looking at the range of crops and activities attracting investment amongst the 698. And this slide, again, just to orient ourselves, this is very similar to the slide we were talking about a moment ago, in that for example, food and ag tech, 308 of the 698 organizations are deploying capital into food and ag tech specifically. And again, that's largely due to the influx of VC firms who have identified opportunities in the space. So we're seeing a range of crops and activities which are attracting capital, whether, as I said, food and ag tech or food processing and distribution, to aquaculture, to indoor ag. It's really, again, a range of crops and activities across the value chain that are attracting investment. So now we're looking at acreage. So this is the top 30 ag investors in terms of acreage that we identified in this process. The top 30 accounts for 48 million acres under management on a global basis, ranging from 11.6 million in the number one spot to 110,000 acres in the number 30 spot. These organizations are producing a range of crops and activities. So row crops, permanent, specialty, as well as livestock. So this number is inclusive of all of that. We have not, for this purpose, separated acreage based off of crop type or activity. So this slide here is fund analysis. So in addition to the other parts of our research, we looked at the actual, as Philippe mentioned, the investment vehicles that are being used to raise and deploy capital. And in the case of commingled funds, we wanted to get a sense of, you know, what the trend has been in terms of successful fundraising and closing. And one thing we don't have on the slide, but I'll just mention briefly, is we identified a total of 469 ag-focused funds that have been at least announced and capital raising has begun for the 698 organizations. Of those 469, 280 have had a successful close. When you look at it from the historical perspective, it is pretty interesting. Following the 2008-2009 financial crisis through 2019, fund closings, so this slide is only showing closings, increased 36% in that decade, which is tremendous. And when you look at just 2019 alone, with 43 successful fund closings, which was a 79% increase over 2018. So I think for those of us in the sector, that's really exciting to see that the investment community is clearly excited about what investing in food and ag can offer.
Yeah, so in terms of the key insights and trends, I'm not gonna spend too much time on these, but maybe highlight a couple of them. Of course, one of the big ones is the number that we identified, $131 billion in global AUM. That's what we've been able to confirm. However, we do know that that probably underrepresents what the true level of AUM is in food and agriculture. And that's something that we're going to work on in the next year to try to obviously nail down. The issue that we have there is that where an investor doesn't have a fund dedicated solely or 100% to investing in food and agriculture, it becomes difficult. We've asked, and of course, we realize that there are fiduciary reasons why in some cases investors cannot break that out for us, but that's something that we're gonna work on. But we do think that the $131 billion is a low figure, but it's a starting point. I think, you know, what that means, I think, is for some of the feedback we've gotten is surprise, even on from individuals who are, you know, full-time focused on this sector. We also anticipate that the financial community in general and the financial media is going to pick up on this moving forward. Food and agriculture offers opportunities for investors to allocate to a number of different types of asset investment strategies with different risk-reward profiles, which may meet their objectives. We see a lot of new, as Mark was mentioning, a lot of new players coming into the sector, which is, I think, promising. A lot of venture capital firms that are bringing in technologies from adjacent industries to leverage opportunities in the sector is exciting. It means new capital, and we see that continuing to grow. We see, as we discussed earlier, a multi-strategy approach increasingly being adopted by asset managers, particularly farmland managers, where they're using a sleeve to invest in private equity because they're investing maybe in permanent crops or more downstream activities relative to their primary focus on crop production or a crop or even venture capital, which where they're seeking to leverage technologies to improve the returns on their farmland investments. Food security, I think, is going to be, we believe, is going to continue to be a strong driver, particularly given the current context of the pandemic, which we'll discuss in a second. We also see growing number of asset managers located outside North America growing over time. We've seen that in Africa and in Asia, and we expect with opportunities growing in developing markets that that's going to continue to grow. One big opportunity we see for the sector is to profile ESG and sustainability capabilities to investors who are seeking to invest to meet mandates for ESG and sustainability. And we think that the food and ag sector is particularly well positioned to be able to take advantage of that for raising capital. And we see that, I think that we're going to see a nexus between continuing growth and the nexus between large scale food production and ag investors as they try to get closer to consumers and mitigate risk in the value chain, or being disintermediated by other players in the value chain. Now, Mark is going to talk about the events or trends we've seen in the first quarter. Mark?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, yeah.
So, sorry about that. Not sure what's happening here. We've begun some preliminary research on next year's report. And through Q1, just wanted to report a couple of things that we found interesting. First of all, we identified 109 new organizations who are not included in this report who deployed or announced deployment of capital into the sector in Q1. Now, a majority of those players are venture capital in terms of pursuing a food and ag tech approach. But so as a result of that, the check sizes is going to be smaller than maybe other strategies. But nonetheless, it's 109 new players who are not part of this report. Elsewhere, in terms of pension fund activity, we have two notable announcements for capital deployments. In Massachusetts, Mass Prim announced a $500 commitment to Prudential. And in New York, the New York State Common Retirement Fund announced a commitment of $300 million to Avenue Capital. So certainly a notable dollar amounts there. Finally, alternative proteins remain attractive and exciting to investors. At the beginning of March, Pyrrhus announced a $25 capital raise on top of the $75 million invested by Cargill in August of last year. And then recently on St. Patrick's Day, Impossible Foods announced a $500 million capital raise as well. So the opportunities in alternative proteins are still of particular interest to the investment community.
So this slide is really maybe for people attending the webinar who are not conversant and haven't spent much time in the sector. We just wanted to make the point that when you look at returns on institutional investor returns on farmland properties in the U.S. and Australia, which are obviously big producers, both countries of agricultural production, and they also are attract the substantial amounts of investments by institutional investors in those real assets in those countries. You can see that the returns, the positive returns, as tracked by NCREIF, both in the U.S. and in Australia in 2019, and also in the fourth quarter of last year. So we haven't seen the first quarter. I haven't seen the first quarter results yet for this year by NCREIF, but I think that this is kind of emblematic of the sort of returns that investors will be looking for, particularly in a period where and certain class of investors looking for long-term allocations, where they're in facing markets that are currently whirling because of the downturn in global because of the pandemic. In terms of the impact of coronavirus on food and agriculture, I think you need to look at it. We think you need to look at it in terms of near term and long term. Here, focused here, looking on commodity, you know, near term, the impact on commodity crops. You know, there's sufficient carryout inventories due to good harvest in previous years. By that, commodity crops, we're talking about, you know, basically globally traded row crops. And some derivatives such as dairy. There is volatility because of different demand functions by crops. So not all crops are equal. One also has to consider that there's a what we see particularly here in the U.S., because we're following it just because we're based here, there's a distinction in terms of how crops are, the demand for crops from food service usage versus retail usage. And we see dramatic downturns in prices for those commodities, such as dairy that goes particularly used in school lunches and in food service type applications where there's an oversupply and a mismatch between demand and supply. And that's obviously causing bottlenecks and disruptions in the value chain. In terms of high value crops, the story is still out. Obviously, those crops tend to be labor intensive, which is not going to be an advantage in an era of social distancing. It poses challenges, which I think a lot of growers and producers are addressing, but it's the jury's still out as to how that's going to pan out. There would be some concerns about in the Northern Hemisphere about the crop being planted in time and having sufficient amount of labor, not only in the lower tier of the United States, but also in the upper tier where fresh vegetables and fruits are planted, whether that's going to happen in time. And of course, just looking down the road, since those crops are highly perishable, is there going to be a sufficient amount of labor to avoid losses before it arrives to market? And then we haven't seen any further reporting on it, but it was quite disconcerting to see that a tiger in the Bronx Zoo apparently caught, contracted, or a number of tigers did, COVID-19. We raised the question as to what does that mean for transfer of this disease to livestock operations. I haven't seen much news about that since, but we just raised that as a warning signal to something to track. We do see that governments are imposing limitations on exports to protect domestic consumers, such as Russia did with wheat last month. We think that government intervention is going to be more frequent than it has been in the past couple of years due to food security concerns. And overall, we question whether reliance on long supply chains is going to what sort of operating risks that's going to pose to value-added food processors. I think that there's a saying now that distance is back, and so distance is going to be an issue, and of course our industry depends on distance, so that's something to track. Longer term, I think that agriculture has a role to play, particularly in farmland investing, in addressing improving productivity on existing cultivated land to avoid pressures on incursions into frontier regions. A lot of the pandemics that have occurred are because of humans going into areas where we didn't operate before, and having getting into close proximity to animals where there's been a transfer to humans of different viruses. We also think that the COVID-19 has been a major challenge, bacterial infections challenge to human populations going forward. And obviously there's fear about developing microbial resistance and to antibiotics. So there's a role for animal protein production to play there. And then just in adoption of ESG standards and sustainable production practices as the benchmarks for the industry is something that we see the industry being able maybe to be a leader and go out in front. I would make a little plug here for some of the impact investors where we've really been impressed by their benchmarking and their tracking of the impact that their investments are having both on the economy, the regions where they're operating, the local populations, and how their investment dollars are generating value. It's I think there are actually they're a model to look at, and I think a lot of private investors will start looking more at how the impact investors are doing the reporting, because I think there's something to be learned there. Longer term, in terms of opportunities, we see the current meltdown in the financial markets providing opportunities for investors to allocate to the sector. We've identified here a couple of opportunities or trends where we think investors could could see some you know, could pursue some opportunities in terms of how they allocate to the sector. We think that we're going to see increased adoption of robotics combined with AI because of social distancing. We think that consumer habits are going to change, more focus on purchasing locally grown products, maybe more focus on seasonal eating products that in season, a little bit more, particularly here in the U.S., a little bit more similar to what happens in Europe. We think that indoor agriculture will also be an attractive area, not necessarily vertical agriculture, but indoor agriculture located near large urban areas outside, though not necessarily in highly concentrated urban areas, but outside, to be able to produce and deliver products efficiently. Already before the pandemic, we saw, and we have been seeing, an interest in food safety testing and certification technologies and services, and I think that's only going to accelerate faster. And then I think that there will be a lot of rethinking of logistics handling and infrastructure reconfiguration that will provide opportunities for them. So now we are ready for Q&A. I look forward to your questions, and both about the webinar presentation and maybe, and if you have questions about the report itself.
Thank you, Philippe and Mark. I have a couple that have come in that are specific to strategies within AgAUM. So I'm going to do one of those that came in via email, followed by the one that's in the chat. So you mentioned that farmland investing accounts for the largest percentage of AgAUM at 39%. Do you expect that to continue?
And this is Philippe Laperouse. Yeah, we think that it will continue. We think but we do think that other sectors or other asset strategies will increase the percentage of total AUM. But we do think, I mean, we just saw the two announcements, two major commitments in March by pension funds, and we think that will continue.
Okay. The other one is specific to credit and debt. The questioner has said, I noticed the credit debt is relatively small versus the other strategies by AUM, but larger based on the number of funds targeting it. Can you explain that difference? And who are groups that might execute credit and debt as the primary strategy?
Well, go ahead, Mark.
Sorry, yeah, one thing I will just say regarding that is I think it's a little bit inverted in that credit debt in terms of AgAUM accounts for about 32% of allocated AgAUM, whereas the actual number of funds that we identified in the report itself, we've identified about 20% of the funds of having a credit debt focused strategy. And the reason why there's a gap there is because that's only the funds. A large number of credit debt investors are deploying or using other strategies like separately managed accounts. So that the separately managed organizations who are just doing separately managed accounts but have a credit debt strategy, they're not included in that 20% number. So again, that 20% is only reflective of the funds that we specifically identified that are pursuing those specific strategies. So that's why there's a gap.
Okay. Now we have a couple on geographic distribution as well, one via email and one in the chat. I'm going to kind of try to hybridize them a little bit. The first being, what regions are likely to attract capital for investment in food and ag, and pursuing which investment strategies? And then the one in the chat is slightly similar. Do you have information on geographic distribution of farmland investment, foreign versus domestic, for export versus domestic consumption? So that's a little bit of a difficult way to mishmash those geography questions, but I guess information on geographic distribution of farmland investment specifically.
Right. Well, the challenge we have, of course, is that we have not, and we could have certainly asked, but I'm not sure that we could get confirmation from asset managers that are pursuing farmland real asset strategies that they would provide us with a breakdown of the AUM by region. Obviously, if we could obtain that, we would be able to make that calculation. So what we have done is identify, based on our analysis and research, where those asset managers are operating and where they've invested. But we have not been able unless, of course, we know that an investor or an asset manager is investing 100% in a region. But if they're investing across regions, it's hard to break that down. In terms of, I think there was the other question is if we could distinguish between farmland that was dedicated towards production for domestic consumption versus exports. And of course, that's also challenging because a lot of the funds are selling into the market, and that you know the channel that it flows into will depend on players downstream and the grain trading companies, unless the investor has is vertically integrated and is operating throughout the supply chain through to the end destination markets.
And just to stick a little bit with geography, we have a question on your views on food and ag investment opportunities in emerging markets, specifically in this case in Russia. And you know, is that interesting? Do you see that there will be more investor interest in emerging markets moving forward?
Well, yeah, I think we do. I mean, Africa, despite all the bad news, and we'll obviously. And given the current context, it remains to be seen, how the sub-Saharan countries in Africa are able to deal with the pandemic. But prior to that, we have seen over the past couple of years increases in investment in Africa. And we think because for a lot of reasons. First, it's a big consumer of protein. It's got demographically, it's the fastest growing continent or has been until recently in terms of population. Rapid urbanization of the populations in most of those countries, and rising GDP. So Africa is really we think a very interesting place for pioneers to consider investing, and we have seen increased investment in the sector. So obviously now with the pandemic, I mean that may raise some questions in the short term. But so we see Africa being an attractive area. We see Asia as well as being attractive, East and Southern Asia, and we've seen investments going into that sector as well.
And just to add to Philippe's
Europe
comment
and
briefly.
Russia, can you address that?
I'm sorry, I forgot that. I wouldn't necessarily refer to Russia as an emerging market. Actually, I mean, there has been substantial investment made in Russia by a number of asset managers. I don't see that necessarily increasing. I think that on the part of global institutional investors, I think that we've seen. Over the last decade, we saw substantial investments be made in the sector, but I think that the international market, for a host of reasons, has pulled back because of geopolitical considerations. And there is capital available within Russia to pursue those investments.
I love how on the same page a lot of people are with, I'm able to combine some questions here. I have another one specific to the coronavirus pandemic. I think this is an interesting question. Do you think that the pandemic will move ag strategies more back to the basics, safely into farmland, or do you think it will push the evolution towards a more complex business model?
Well, no, I don't think it's going to be back to the basics. I think it's, I don't want to say it's exciting because it's don't want to, be too optimistic, but I think that it's going to call on a lot of new technologies, new business models, new approaches. I think that it's exciting that a lot of VCs have gotten into the space. When you think of social distancing, when you think of changing industry structures. I think that food and agriculture, not as I mentioned in the what we discussed, you know, in the slide, I think it has a very large role and responsibility to play. I think the governments are going to get involved in terms of maybe providing some incentives to reduce the pressures on encroaching on land that is in land reserves, particularly, you know, so that, you know, there's more productivity on existing land production. So I think that we're going to see a lot of different things happening that will be actually supportive of agriculture as it exists today. But I don't think it's going to go back to I think it's going to get more complex and create more opportunities. I think if you take the U.S., Eastern U.S., I think we'll see more local production, let's say east of the Mississippi River, to be able to supply some of the big cities along the eastern seaboard. We've already seen that in some of the models investors have started to deploy, rather than relying on large-scale agriculture, which still has a role. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but I think we're going to see a lot of different plays on how do you approach this market. And then, you know, as we mentioned, indoor agriculture is another evolving trend that we think is going to have long legs.
Well, now that you mentioned that, we have a question specific to vertical ag in terms of you're saying you see great promise for indoor ag or controlled environment ag in general, but can you talk a little bit about what role you see vertical ag playing?
Well, I don't pretend to be an expert on vertical agriculture. I think it probably does have its role in certain markets, particularly if you think about the Middle East and water scarce climates. But I think that the Dutch model of greenhouses leveraging solar panels makes a lot of sense for a country such as the U.S., where you can leverage solar energy and land. I think vertical agriculture has some challenges, just because if you're thinking about putting it into a large, urban environment where real estate is expensive, I don't know that it really pencils out in the long term. And it seems to me that there's another approach that could be taken for using environmentally controlled indoor agriculture.
And just to add a quick comment, I was just going to say, as Sleep said earlier, as supply chains potentially have to get smaller and constrict, things like controlled environment agriculture really have an opportunity to help serve more people. Now, obviously, as Sleep said, there's geographical and real estate and cost challenges related to those operations and getting them up and running. But regardless, if the supply chains that we have traditionally relied upon are going to have to change, there's going to be an opportunity for new players.
Thank you. This is a question about farmland pricing in the U.S. Can you give us some thoughts on that, given significant drop in the ethanol markets and the closures of ethanol facilities? What effect do you think this will have on corn?
On corn prices?
I'm assuming yes, or farmland.
Yeah, certainly will have an impact on farmland pricing. It's already had obviously an impact on corn prices. So it will. The interesting thing will be what planters' intentions are, how the crop gets planted this coming year. So we've already seen a more, an evolution. It's not, hasn't become large scale, but we've already seen a lot more novel type crops being started to be planted, farmers experimenting with different crops, not just relying on the typical rotation. So I think that we'll just see that continue, maybe to accelerate from where it started.
We have a question here on the composition of the credit and debt investors. Mark, maybe you can walk us through that. The question is, can you tell us about the mix of private equity, pension funds? Like what is the composition of credit and debt investors in the report?
Sure. It's a mix of asset managers and DFIs, development finance institutions. As we were proceeding in the development of the report, we began credit debt largely on the private side. And as we continued to look at this, we realized we needed to include other organizations who are very much involved in credit debt financing, but we weren't thinking of it in terms of things like mortgages and other debt vehicles. So, our largest player is MetLife as a result of that portfolio. So it's very much a range of organizations, but the largest of which would be financial institutions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a couple of questions, one on the chat and one in email regarding returns. I know that wasn't really, covered in the report, but I wonder if you'd like to take a whack at it in terms of what kinds of returns private equity or VC ag investors, ag managers are declaring during fundraising for LPs. There is a question of, reported returns in the last 10 years through email. So I think there seems to be some attendee interest in what kind of returns we're looking at, and maybe that's something for the next report, but I thought you might like to address it.
Well, I mean, the returns, of course, are different for different strategies, and so it'd be difficult to give a general rule. But I mean, if you think about it, you're farmland investing. You're investing for the long term. Your return is comprised of long term appreciation of the land over what would be a holding period of in excess of 15, 20 years, 25 years, with current returns. So, those returns have compressed over the last couple of years because of the large carryout stocks, bumper crops in both North and South America and row crops. The private equity investing in agriculture is competing with funds going into private equity in other sectors, maybe at a lower return, but nonetheless, not in the same range that you would be expecting from farmland investing. And then I think that impact investing is probably within the same range or a little bit lower. And then if you're looking at venture capital, I think venture capital is looking at making large returns on, and spreading, spreading the risk in a number of different early stage ventures and looking for returns within a window of 5 years or less. And so the pressure on the returns is rather high to make sure that at least one or two successes out of a portfolio of maybe 10, seven or eight investments is going to generate that return for the portfolio.
Good job with a tough question, Philippe. What do you mean by infrastructure in the report when it comes to ag investing? What are you classifying as an infrastructure strategy?
Mark, do you want to take that or you want me to?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, infrastructure, we mean logistics, for permanent crops, the construction or investment in processing packing facilities. We mean by that we mean handling facilities for processing or handling and transport of commodities, whether it's crops or even processing of animal protein. So a range of different activities where you're investing in hard assets.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's the key thing there, Philippe. Sorry, just to say the hard asset itself versus the actual processing capability.
Right. Right.
Can you expound on the impact investment benchmarking structures and what you think is working well there, and how they're monitoring?
Well,
long term?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one fast rule. It was just that something that Mark and I noticed when we, because we spent a lot of time reviewing and looking at lots of websites and reading reports and, you know, and looking at what, how people were reporting. And, you know, the impact investors have to be fair, they have somewhat of an easier job in the sense that that's how they raise funds, is by being transparent. And of course, their modus operandi is to be very transparent about how, you know, the funds they've raised and then the impact that the investments that they've made have had via the, you know, their allocations into different types of activities. So, and they've just said, what we've been impressed by is their ability to track those year to year, year on year, and report on those to their investors. And of course, that's required by their investors. But it's just, some of them are quite sophisticated. I was surprised. I wasn't expecting that. And the level of sophistication for some is quite high. So I was just saying that, I mean, it made our job a lot easier in the sense, being able to, you know, to parse out what they were doing, where they're investing, what type of activities they're investing in, and what their allocations were, because everything was very transparent.
Okay, great. I'm sorry, y'all, that I'm bouncing back and forth a little bit, but we just got a question back to the infrastructure topic. Mm-hmm. Are you counting water infrastructure in terms of a fund that might marry water assets with water-stressed farmland, or would you count that in farmland itself?
Yes, we would. I mean, we are not, we haven't, I mean, we've already only tracked investments in water when it's directly related to an investment in land, tied to a land investment. So, but not water infrastructure on its own. So there are some players, and I won't mention any name here in this during the webinar, but I mean, I think, you know, that have invested in land in the Southwest, where they are repurposing the land in terms of what its offtake is for water, in order to generate or to extract value from that water in different applications. And then, you know, maybe, repurposing the land to grow different crops that may be less water intensive. So that's where we would be tracking something. But we're not going out and just looking at straight water plays, which is a completely different sector.
Okay. Kevin, I see you, but we're right at 2:00. So anyone who we didn't get to for your questions, thank you for them. I'm going to have Mark and Philippe follow up with you via email so that maybe y'all can continue the conversation. But I don't want to keep you past the 2:00 hour, but we will do this again. And we hope that you found this to be valuable. We're going to do a series of these with different industry experts. We hope that you'll join as many as you can. If you're interested in delivering your own presentation, please let me know. I'm going to send you all a follow-up email with a recording of this, and also with my information, so that you can contact me and let me know if you'd like to get involved. While we're disappointed that we won't have the chance to be with all of you at our flagship event that was supposed to take place next week, we do hope that we'll have the chance to bring the community together in the last week of August. So please head over to globalaginvesting.com for more details on that. And we hope you have a great day. Philippe and Mark are available to you. So when we follow up, we'll let you know how to get in touch with them. And again, each of you who I didn't get to in the Q&A, I will follow up and make sure you get those questions answered. Thank you all very, very much. Have a wonderful day. Thank you, Philippe and Mark.
Thank you, Kate.